It separates the actual issues from the power struggle over who's right. Once the couple buys into the experiment, obviously an important first step, they act according to their partner's wishes. It also works because it means you're reaffirming your trust in each other. Just by agreeing to the experiment, each partner shows trust, first by complying with the other's wishes, and second, by seeing that neither makes extreme demands, even when they have the power to do so. When they see that the other isn't power-tripping them, each feels safer about hearing the other's preferences and accommodating them. The real benefit? This experiment sure helps decision-making and negotiating once you reach day 28. Know your body language. A wink, a hair stroke, crossed arms. Every nonverbal move or action goes a long way towards communicating whether we want you to hang around or get the hell out of our face. When you consider that 90%, that's 90% of our communication is conveyed nonverbally, then you realize how we gesture is as powerful as what we say. The two parts of the brain that control this kind of communication are the amygdala and the cingulate gyrus, for those of you keeping score at home. Truth is, women are much better at picking up and using signals than men. So women, help your men read your signals better. Reading body language correctly can help head off problems and help you communicate verbally rather than letting issues fester. The way you talk. Roughly 40% of what you communicate is achieved through the components of what's called paralinguistics, the part of nonverbal communication that conveys emotions and attitudes through tone, pitch, volume, pauses, and throat clears. What's even more amazing is that these signals have 5 times more communicative value than the actual spoken words. Specifically, these are some of the messages that can be conveyed about personality traits. An increased rate of speaking generally implies the individual is more animated or extroverted. Flatness in the tone of voice indicates more withdrawn and masculine characteristics. A nasal sound is considered undesirable. A person with a weak voice is usually perceived as lacking confidence, which lowers credibility. A strong voice, on the other hand, shows great confidence. A deeper voice in men means more testosterone at the time of puberty, so more able to defend his spouse. A higher pitched voice in females means more estrogen at puberty, so more able to birth viable children. The way you move. Here's a stat that will blow every neuron in your mind. The human body is capable of making more than 700,000 unique movements and more than 10,000 separate facial configurations, the face and hands being the most expressive parts of our bodies. But the really interesting thing is that all humans make at least a few of the same faces when expressing basic emotions, namely happiness, sadness, surprise, fear, anger, and disgust. These basic expressions are virtually identical in every culture on Earth. And in fact, we don't have the ability to control them, but we do have the intrinsic ability to pick out fakes and impostures. Take the smile. A genuine smile, where the corners of your mouth turn up and the skin around your eyes crinkle, can be produced only as an involuntary response to a genuine emotion. A non-genuine smile is when the lips part and the corners of the mouth are stretched to the sides.
U-tips, improving your sex life. Try tantric. When you hear the term tantric sex, you may assume that we're talking about the ability to have a sexual interlude that lasts longer than a transcontinental flight. But that's not really the goal of tantric sex. The goal stems from the desire and ability to have more of a physical and spiritual connection during sex. Physically, for men, that means developing the ability, as tantrics say, retain the seed. That is, having the ability to control ejaculation to allow sexual energy to flow. But the essence of that practice and of the following tactics is really about mindfulness, or being deeply aware of yourself, your partner, your life, and what's called the sacred life force. Change your mindset. Stop thinking that your sexual satisfaction is the responsibility of your partner. We're all responsible for our own experience. Be open to discussions about sex with your partner, and be open in exploring your own body to help your partner help you. Men, when you're by yourself, you can practice increasing your sexual energy. bring yourself to two or three peaks at a time, ejaculating only after you've come close to the edge a few times. Deep breathing can help you teeter on the edge without falling over. What you're doing is priming your prostate gland like a pump to help improve sexual performance. Be softer. One of the main tenets here is to slow things down. Don't be in such a rush to get to bed or to finish up. Carve out time to have a marathon lovemaking session in which the final goal isn't necessarily an orgasm, but simply the journey itself. Play to your partner's strengths. We all know the whole Mars and Venus debate. Men are different sexual creatures than women. Men respond to new visual cues. Women respond to friendly, emotional ones. Go a little deeper and you'll understand it's more that men respond to fear and excitement, and women respond to intimacy. Instead of agreeing to disagree, couples should capitalize on their differences to help make their partners more comfortable in bed. So what does that mean? A man should make it a habit to look into his partner's eyes during sex. The eye lock is a way to increase intimacy and oxytocin. And a woman should acknowledge that her partner's arousal may be based more on urgency, meaning that it's not so bad to have the lights on during sex, or crave a quickie, or meet up for a lunch hour that involves absolutely no lunch at all. Mix it up. Guys, listen up. While men have orgasms in 95% of sexual encounters, some reports have women having orgasms in 69% of encounters. Obviously, we couldn't have created that statistic and that number by ourselves. Interestingly, the more varied the sexual activity, the more likely a woman is to have an orgasm. That means mixing it up among manual, oral, and genital stimulation. Oral sex, by the way, increases a woman's chance of having an orgasm. Open the fridge. Well, you're probably thinking that we're going to tell you to get some chocolate sauce and whipped cream. The truth is that food plays a vital role in our sexual desire, some because of the smell, some because of the shape, and some because they alter your body chemistry to make you a more desirable mate. Our choices. Take advantage of pheromones. Capitalize on those scents by exposing yourself to them. Research shows that scents of lemons, donuts, and licorice increase penile blood flow. That's necessary for men to achieve an erection. Don't eat the donuts. That slows blood flow dilation down. Just smell. For women, it's licorice and cucumbers. Why? For women, the phallic shape subconsciously plays a large part in that. Another good one to smell for its pheromone effect, baby powder. It makes the female partner think of an evolutionary goal of sex, at least subconsciously. Strengthen the sperm. If your goal is to consummate your attraction with reproduction, then you should also supplement yourself with zinc, selenium, folic acid, and vitamin C and E, which have been shown to increase sperm count. But most important is DHA omega-3 fats, the active ingredient in fish oil that can be obtained in even more purified form from the algae they eat. Go back to that sauce. Chocolate has long been considered a love drug because some of the ingredients have a feel-good effect. One study also shows that caffeine may have a positive effect on female libido. Experiment with more oral sex, fantasies, or watching each other in videos or in real life. Change things up to charge things up. Get comfortable with yourself. You can try to reboot your system by experimenting with your body and finding what brings you joy. For instance, many women like the shaft of their clitoris stimulated rather than the tip, so you need to be able to communicate that to your partner. Get comfortable with the fact that a mirror, sex toys, and locked doors can be a healthy part of a solo experience that can energize your sex life with your partner. Check your waist. Fat doesn't just make it hard for you to see your organs, it also makes it hard for them to function, which is why increasing waist size means decreasing libido. One of the reasons why men lose libido omental fat, that's fat around your belly. That omental fat converts testosterone to estrogen and thus diminishes sex drive. So if you're experiencing a loss of sex drive, a doc may first check the size of your testes. They should be roughly 1.5 inches height to 1 inch width, or 3 finger widths by 2 finger widths. If they're normal size, it could mean that omental fat is causing the testosterone drop. While you're losing the belly fat, a medication called clomiphene, which blocks the conversion from testosterone to estrogen, may help. If you want to keep your libido or get it back, get your waist size to less than half your height. Go all Lombardi on him. When it comes to sex, since women are as silent as a 1920s movie, they fear that they can't tell their men what they want in bed. Maybe because they're shy, maybe because they're embarrassed, or maybe because their partner's ego is as delicate as a silk blouse. But the best thing you can do with your mouth to improve your sex life has nothing to do with X-rated thoughts crossing your mind right about now. It's talking. Women need to teach, coach, and encourage their men to give them what they want and how they want it. Believe us, it's much more of an ego boost for men to know they're pleasing their woman than not to know something was wrong in the first place. Keep it pumping. Good sex isn't just about blindfolds and finger paints. It's really about good blood flow. That ensures you're getting the right nutrients to your brain as well as the right stimuli to your sex organs. So improving your sex life means avoiding the things that decrease blood flow. Nicotine, drugs, saturated fat, trans fat, simple sugars, syrups, diabetes, high blood pressure. And embracing the things that increase blood flow. Exercise, avocados, fruits, vegetables, 100% whole grains, ginseng, ginkgo biloba, L-arginine, lemon, and citrulline. That's the spirit. How to find true happiness. In this section, we're going to explore 6 paths to happiness through deeper meaning and purpose in life, the things that make you truly unique and truly beautiful. Some of these have a clear biological and evolutionary basis, while others are just beginning to be understood. And many of them are starting to gain scientific support for their healing powers. Here, you'll find us talking about things that are extremely personal, things that we'd share and talk about with our own family and friends. We're not backing a particular religion or saying there's one spiritual prescription to heal all problems, but we do believe that this area of health, that which addresses deep issues of the soul, is absolutely worth exploring and talking about with those close to you. In any case, it's clear that a beautiful being isn't about just what you can do for yourself, but what gifts you can pass to others.
The 6 paths to happiness. Be positive and generous. We all have friends or family who fit the polar ends of personality. The cheerleader types who can smile even after getting puddle-pummeled by a bus, and the negative types who frown at butterflies. Positive emotions play a crucial role in developing the enduring relationships that are critical for our happiness. One example, the boomerang smile. That is, a shared smile between mother and baby. We know negative emotions change our brain function to increase stress, which increases the risk of things such as cancer and heart disease. Since we also know positive emotions change the way brains function to reduce stress, they can help cancel out those health risks. The best evidence comes from studies on meditation and relaxation therapies, which show their ability to calm a jumpy heart. Other studies have found a strong correlation between positive moods and the improvement of physical symptoms, such as listlessness and weakened immune function. All are clearly contributors to happiness, or lack thereof. Part of the reason happiness is an important part of the beautiful triumvirate is that you can't really feel happy unless your body feels tuned and your mind feels sharp. Without a sound body, you can't form a sound mind. One of the strongest correlates of happiness is having the health to accomplish your purposes in life. Almost every study of longevity indicates one secret that makes people healthier and happier: helping others. Some research shows that a 60% decrease in mortality figures among those who help others. They're aided by what's called the helper's high. Specifically, it's the dignity, the joy, the passion, and the purpose of helping others. Whether it's helping another person quit smoking, building a home for a person in need, or mentoring a child at school, that have these beneficial effects. Research shows that people who donate money are happier than people with the same amount of money who don't donate to others. Helping others inspires gratitude for what life has given you, and this is what really turbocharges your happiness and helps you define your own purpose in life. After all, the real secret may be realizing that true peace isn't about being happy, giddy, or feeling as if you're charged up on Red Bull all the time. It's about slowing down enough to realize that you have a lot of gifts, gifts that you should be passing along to others. Feeling empathy. In the same way we know people with extremist personalities, we all know people at both ends of the empathy spectrum. The ones who will rush right over with a freshly baked lasagna when your cat dies, and the ones who make you work until 9 p.m. on the night your kid has a solo in the 7th grade choral concert. Typically, we'd call the latter Scrooge cold-hearted, but the biology's all wrong. Ain't the heart that's cold, it's the brain. As with virtually every one of our biologic functions, there's a survival value in feeling empathy for others. Teaming up with a community to get a job done or fend off an attack is more advantageous than doing it alone. It's more than just adaptation at play, though. It's a brain function. Our moral system is largely dependent on how connected we feel with others. The more connected we feel, the higher our degree of generosity and compassion. Part of the biology comes from a phenomenon involving what's called mirror neurons. Someone does something around you. They yawn or cross their arms. And you pick up on it and reflect the same action back. Mirror neurons, like tiny neurological video cameras, record life as it happens. That's how children learn, and why you may pick up a southern accent after living a year in Louisiana. These neurons are found in various areas of the brain, and they fire in response to people's actions. When you see a person performing an action, you automatically want to simulate the action with the brain. Certain circuits in the brain may actually prevent you from doing it, though. This applies to watching someone dance on Dancing with the Stars or serve an ace at the U.S. Open, which is why we can perform better after a real pro shows us the way. Mirror neurons enabled the brains of our ancestors to increase dramatically in size because their learning and survival ability grew so dramatically. The cool thing is that mirror neurons don't fire only with yawning and other inconsequential bodily blurts. Your mirror neurons also react to emotions, generating empathy. When you see someone touched in a painful way, your own pain areas are affected. When you see a spider crawl up someone's leg, you feel a creepy sensation because your own mirror neurons are firing. Social emotions, such as guilt and shame, embarrassment and lust, are based on a uniquely human mirror neuron system found in a part of the brain called the insula. Remember, that's the part of the brain associated with addictions. It's why you feel sad in the face of tragedy. You can empathize with the people who experience it. It's what allows you to connect with other humans and transcend your differences. It's also one of the reasons why church services and rituals can be so effective in helping people stay happy. They help teach you how you're supposed to feel and how powerful it can be to help others. We also know that different parts of the brain react depending on the morality of the decisions you make. In some MRI tests, researchers found that the left frontal lobe and temporal lobes were activated when making moral judgments. And it seems that when some of that neural circuitry is injured, morality can be impaired. Cats have a very small frontal lobe, so they tend to not be as compassionate. Women appear to access this part of the brain, not the cat's their own, more than men, especially during childbearing years. Finding authenticity. With all due respect to our brethren in the animal kingdom, there's no question that human beings sit atop the earthly hierarchy. After all, it's not as if ants developed a space shuttle, or a leopard penned Macbeth, or northern birds text message each other about their final Florida destination. While it would be nice to sit back, thump our chests, and extol the many virtues of mind and body, the true human experience, that which serves as one foundation for being beautiful, happens not necessarily because we're smarter, it happens because we're deeper. That, folks, begs a pretty big question. Where does the being in human being come from? Let's think of being as existing on three levels, ranging from automatic instinctual actions to highly developed spiritual and contemplative ones. Who we are and what we feel represents a highly fluid meshing of multiple forces in all three of the following levels. Level one is automatic being, the most primitive of the levels. This one is essentially categorized by our animal within. We hungry, we eat. We tired, we sleep. We tingle, we make babies. Simply, the emotional center in your brain decides how you feel, and your mental motherboard tells you not to overthink, just act. Level two is educated being. If level one is primal, then level two is cultural or social. We learn how to feel or behave in certain situations and then act accordingly. Much of these actions are based on routines of how we've learned to do things, and they're not instinctual. For example, how we argue or how we drive to work using the same path every day. Here, our brains take the information we receive, process it for a moment, but just for a moment, and then move on. Level three is authentic being. This third level is what separates man from meerkat. It involves the uniquely human capacity to enlarge our attention, to contemplate the big picture, and to be open-minded enough to think beyond primal instincts and learned habitual behaviors. Perhaps the best way to describe this level is through the image of a wheel with a hub and spokes. In essence, authenticity happens when you can shift your thinking to realize that you're not the hub in the center of the wheel, but are connected to the center at all times, and the world works together elegantly. You're just one of the many nodes in a highly interconnected world of relationships. Most of our lives are spent driven by external factors and motivators, striving for that pay raise, a promotion, or a Hummer limo, as opposed to the intrinsic ones with a higher ideal, a love of the work you do, or your purpose. So to find our true authentic self and be happy about what we find, we must know how we exist in relationship to other things, specifically to other people and to the world at large. One of the reasons why finding and being a good buddy are so important. When we break through the instincts and the habits, we break through a level of superficiality that many people typically tend to live with. And that's when we break through to a deeper experience in our life. This takes time, some practice, and some energy. In fact, our brains can dramatically increase their energy consumption levels when we focus. Since the brain consumes 20 to 25% of our calories when we're at rest, augmenting its activity can be an important change in the status quo.
Embracing emotion. If you understand the magnificent machinery that is the human brain, you'll better understand why some of us bounce around with great joy and others slouch through life like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. That 3-pound bugger is more powerful than our strongest computer, more artistic than a Renaissance painter, and often more mysterious than our entire universe. Every day we're pummeled with thousands upon thousands of pieces of information. And it's not just information per se, like the kind you read in the paper or an email. Sometimes it's informational stimuli that you take for granted as part of your everyday routines, such as traffic lights or coffee shop menus. Frankly, your brain is pretty darn good at inputting all that info, red equals stop, venti is in the extra large cup. But because of that influx and onslaught of sensory information, we need some kind of prioritizing system to help manage the inflow. Remember from our section on stress that our neurologic gatekeeper is the amygdala, which instantly assigns emotional meaning to this type of information. Often we suppress those emotions, even though they're automatic. Our goal here shouldn't be to ignore emotions when they come up, whether we are reacting painfully to the loss of a loved one or getting angry when we're mad at our boss or kids. In fact, we're biologically hardwired to pay attention to emotions and use them intelligently. For example, we recommend that you use empathy to help harness anger, like maybe thinking that the jerk at work has some home stresses that are causing him to be a jerk. Our goal should be to observe emotions and even learn to think with these emotions to help give our lives even deeper meaning. That is why meditation is not the emptying out of our brains so they are devoid of ideas, but rather a technique to gently nudge out ideas that enter without your becoming emotionally attached. Now more than ever, we're understanding the biology behind this sense of transcendence beyond our typical reality. For example, we're now able to explain how out-of-body experiences happen, at least physically. The primary senses of sight, smell, hearing, and touch have great blood supply, but the part of the temporal lobe that integrates these senses together is in a watershed area that suffers from inadequate oxygen when your blood pressure drops too low. When this happens, the sensory input becomes disconnected. Many people who have had near-death experiences reported leaving their bodies. Transcendent experiences are also associated with things such as hallucinogenic drugs and even orgasms, when you experience the feeling that nothing else matters. Thankfully, humans have healthy ways of achieving these states of disconnect, meditation. As we search for meaning in life, we're moved by these experiences that reveal the big picture. Exploring spirituality. For some, being spiritual means going to church every day. For others, it means finding a silent place to meditate and think about the bigger picture in life. You're less likely to be disturbed in your bathroom. And for a few, it means closing your eyes and looking to the sky when the field goal kicker is looking at a 50-yarder with time running out. There is some hotly disputed evidence suggesting a genetic influence in the amount or degree of spirituality a person can have, that people who are more spiritual than others actually have a gene that's linked to a specific spirituality receptor in the brain, which would mean that people have various dispositions for feeling spiritual, just the same way they have various predispositions for heart disease. Of course, we also have the ability to tweak, modify, and change those predispositions with the choices we make, just as in people with predispositions for heart disease. You may remember from You Staying Young that the telomere caps on the tips of our chromosomes are a way of judging your rate of aging. The longer your telomeres, the more your stem cells can reproduce and repair damage elsewhere in your body, and the younger you are. People with purposes in life, ones that don't stress them, have much longer telomeres, almost 8 years worth longer, than the chronologic age and other health behavior would justify. The telomeres seem to be elongated by having that purpose. Scientists have long speculated that religious feelings can be tied to a specific place in the brain. They found this out by studying a form of epilepsy in which seizures originate as electrical misfirings within the temporal lobes. Epileptics who have this form of disorder often report intense religious experiences, leading researchers to speculate that localized electric storms in the brain's temporal lobes might sometimes be related to religious experience. These feelings may be connected to the limbic system, which comprises the interior regions of the brain that govern emotion and emotional memory. Those are the amygdala and hypothalamus. It's also possible that different religious feelings arise from distinct locations in the brain, and individual differences might also exist. So now the question is, how can you learn to be spiritual? Well, primarily through training your brain with transcendent experiences such as meditation or prayer. That is, altering your state of consciousness to focus on a sacred image or thought. Maybe you got your first taste of prayer before meals or before going to bed. Maybe you pray every Sunday or every day. Or maybe the only time you've ever prayed was in the half second your car hydroplaned on the highway. Clearly, we all have different perceptions of what praying means and what it does. And like many other things, prayer works for some people and doesn't do diddly for others. There are a lot of conflicting data to do with the effect of prayer proving just that. For us, prayer isn't asking for a specific answer or outcome, give us rain, but rather gaining the ability to cope with a desperate situation, drought. The purpose of prayer isn't to change the divine or alter what your God is thinking, but to change you, to give you the strength to manage tough times. Prayer to us is somewhat interchangeable with meditation in that it's silent contemplation. Few people would say that prayer gets the medical and scientific attention that, say, Alzheimer's research gets. But that doesn't mean that there isn't some impressive scientific evidence about the power of prayer. For example, we know that prayer and meditation change neurologic structures. Meditation leads to a thicker cortex. Any kind of regular mental activity builds new brain connections. And we know that meditation works for relaxation, at least partially by soothing the vagus nerve, a nerve that carries a truckload of information to the brain. So you can build up your brain, just like your biceps, if you're doing the correct exercises. Some studies show that the frontal lobe, which deals with concentration, lights up like a campfire during prayer and meditation. Still, other researchers used EEG tests to show that meditating monks had higher than normal gamma waves, which are thought to be helpful in synchronizing separate forms of brain function to help form a unified perception of the world. And believe it or not, though your body is not spending energy during such meditation, your brain can almost double its activity level. Regardless of what motivates people to pray, there's no denying that a lot of people do it. One study shows that 36% of people use complementary and alternative medicine, but that number almost doubles when prayer is included in the definition. Those respondents say they use prayer for their own health and to help others. Even more telling, of those people who said they prayed for health reasons, 70% said that prayer was helpful. Why? Seems as though it may work through several different mechanisms. It relaxes. Meditation is a form of prayer, no matter what your religious preferences. And prayer helps to slow breathing and brain activity and reduces heart rate and blood pressure. All relaxing, all good. It's positive. Let's face it, when you pray, you typically don't finish feeling as though you want to wrap someone's ankles with a wooden spoon. Afterward, you're filled with peace, joy, and other emotions that are worthy of being printed on holiday cocktail napkins. There is some evidence that these emotions lead to positive physiologic responses throughout the entire body. Our stress hormone levels prepare for a peaceful existence. Perhaps more important, our immune system becomes less agitated so that chemicals such as pro-inflammatory cytokines, which act like kerosene on a fire, are not driving our joints and arteries to overreact to every biologic stress inside us. The result, a less inflamed, more beautiful place to live. It's better than nothing. That's the placebo effect. We'd be remiss in our reporting if we didn't say that some of the benefits derived from prayer can be accounted for simply because the person feels as if it's helping, whether it's helping physiologically or not. Placebo responses account for as much as 70% of the beneficial effects of some medical procedures and drugs. Our stance here is that thinking that you're doing something good to help yourself is a big part of prayer anyway. It's supernatural. Perhaps the hardest reason to quantify, it's also one of the most powerful. Praying people believe in supernatural forces and in a God's ability to heal, and that seems to have a strong effect on their health, even though the real mechanism of effectiveness is through one of the three previous reasons. Now, no two mystics describe their otherworldly experiences in the same way, and it can be difficult to distinguish among the various types of mystical experiences, be they spiritual, traditionally religious, or simply awe-inspiring moments. If you're an atheist and you live a certain kind of experience, you will relate it to the magnificence of the universe. If you're a Christian, you'll associate it with God. The point for us isn't the differences between our spiritual experiences, but rather the similarities, and that we can get to that place in a lot of different ways. We think it's likely that future tests and studies will continue to show the relationship between health and silent meditation. In fact, we feel that understanding these mystical energies is the next big frontier in medicine. That is, we define life at the level of the cell. As long as the membrane maintains an energy gradient between the inside and the outside world, our cells are alive. When you aggregate cells into organs and then put them in the right spot to make a human, you have life. That's why we're interested in adjusting energy in the body through such vehicles as acupuncture, homeopathy, pulse magnetic fields, and hard-to-explain methods like Reiki and prayer. After all, the thing that matters in life, like love, can't always be measured with blood machines and complex calculations. They're measured in the way you live. Understanding unhappiness. Here's a surprise for you. Being happy means that you realize that there are times when you'll be unhappy and recognize that life sometimes stinks. What's uplifting in those times is appreciating life and facing the challenges that come with it, realizing that you're facing challenges fellow humans have also faced. Now let's be clear that we're not saying that you should lower your expectations for your so-called perfect life or downsize your goals. We just believe that if you can align your expectations with reality a little more by expecting to face challenges, you'll be better off in the end. There's an interesting biologic reinforcement for this notion, too. Your levels of C-reactive protein are a marker of damaging inflammation. Those C-reactive protein levels have been shown to be higher when you have expectations that are unattainable. Makes sense. You worry when you're not hitting goals, so that makes your body more vulnerable to stress. We need to start learning how to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Depending on whom you live with, work with, or share poker chips with, you've probably heard every lament there is. Unhappy with a job, unhappy with a spouse, unhappy that the TV remote is lost again. These unhappy moments stress us and cause inflammation in the rest of the body and less focus for our brain. While our goal here is certainly to find a steady level of peace and happiness in our lives, we also know that we can't expect our euphoria to last as long as a Walmart week, 24/7. There's actually some benefit to experiencing some unhappiness. The original survival value of unhappiness, when you are unhappy and pessimistic, you are better prepared for problems that might arise. Today, though, unhappiness still serves an important purpose. Unhappiness forces you to think through problems that help you gain wisdom and perspective, to think about what gives you happiness so you can set new directions and develop new ideas that may actually change your life. Let's take smokers as an example. Part of the reason smokers have such difficulty quitting is that they have developed a misaligned coping mechanism. You're stressed by that boss, so you go out to smoke, but the boss is still there when you return. Smokers often feel that they're locked into a cycle of unhappiness. When they quit, they're unhappy, and they feel as if they're the only people in the world who are, so they get even unhappier, which makes them want to smoke again to feel happy again. But realizing that the cycle of unhappiness is natural could actually help smokers and others facing challenges get through tough times. But remember, happiness also correlates with having the health to achieve your goals. So getting rid of maladaptive coping mechanisms, like smoking or other unhealthy habits, is important too. If you can't align your expectations with your reality, you're more likely to experience an inner conflict that gently and often subconsciously tugs, gnaws, and claws at you because something doesn't feel quite right. Seems so simple, yet most of us are confounded by even the simplest behavior modifications needed to course correct. Why? Because most of our perceptions and actions are subconscious and automated, which has tremendous survival value for each of us, but does not offer the autonomy we crave to bring our expectations and reality into sync. So much of our life is lived with a veneer crafted around us to protect us, to shield us, to keep our true selves away from the world. Very few times do we get to experience a true, deep reality when the veneer's gone and we see the bigger picture of what's out there in the world, how we fit into it, and how we can help others. We obsess over our day-to-day responsibilities. We fret about making a mistake at work. And we taunt and nag and snipe at people we dislike and sometimes people we love. In essence, we're often shackled by the superficiality of our world. You might live too much in the past and future when you should be bathing in the present, when you could be thinking about relationships, about new ideas, and about all the deeper truths of the world, your world, and how you fit into it.
U-tips. We wear scrubs, not collars. We deliver medicine, not sermons. And our specialty is biology, not theology. So we're not going to stand at a pulpit and try to deliver 10 commandments for moral living. However, to dismiss the very distinct link between looking, feeling, and being a beautiful being would be a great mistake. So we're going to stand here and offer our prescription for doing the right thing, embracing spirituality, and finding a happier you. Give, then pass. There are few feelings in the world that surpass that of knowing you've helped someone. It feels good, and it is good. So good, in fact, that some researchers have found that the effect of giving is similar to the so-called runner's high, the rush of endorphins. But unlike exercise euphoria, this rush can last a long time. The evidence? 90% of people who experience this high give their health condition a better grade than those who don't. The reason? It seems that charity might really start at home. Your thoughts about helping others help you. They seem to be able to do things that strengthen your immune system, boost positive emotions, decrease pain, and provide stress relief. Separate studies show that charitable heart attack patients recover faster than those who aren't, and those who do volunteer work have death rates 40% lower than those who don't. Create rituals. One of the reasons why church, music, and prayer can be such an uplifting experience is that the weekly rituals reinforce a sense of community. You can experience those spiritual highs by attending church, but you can also do it through other rituals, such as nature walks with a group of people in your neighborhood, or an annual trip with your family, or a nightly dinnertime routine in which each person shares one wonderful thing that happened to him or her that day. Say thanks. Any parent raising a child knows how much time is spent teaching that child some manners. Say thank you when someone gives you a present. Say thank you when someone holds the door. As adults, we surely don't need reminders for the typical thank you moments. But many of us may need reminders to do so beyond the typical door openings and gift receiving. After all, part of our purpose here is to get a little deeper, right? Once a week, or more often as you enjoy it more, think of someone who has had an effect on your life, big or small, and write that person a note of gratitude. Not via email either. Be personal. Gratitude is one of the gifts you can give others that also has some selfish benefits. Some research shows that 15 minutes of daily gratitude can dramatically decrease stress hormones in your body. Use spirituality as a tool. Some people say they're spiritual. Some go to church regularly. But the real test of your spirituality is to apply it skillfully when you need it to solve real life issues. That is, can you think before you act? Can you use things such as deep breathing, meditation, and prayer to help you be humble, compassionate, and empathetic when you're under high stress or when you have a family crisis? That ability and skill is really at the heart of what transcendence is all about. So what do you do? It means doing things like counting to 10 before overreacting with emotion in an argument with a spouse or family member. It means slowing down the thought process so you're really thinking through problems and conflicts and using your authentic being to address issues. It means asking yourself not what your spiritual leader of choice would do about a conflict, but what would he or she feel about this challenge. You want to tap into your heart more than control a behavior. And it means taking an issue one step further than its surface-level solution. So, for example, if a child is starting to get bad grades at school, find out what else is going on in the child's life. Be a better believer. Funny to hear it said that way. You can be a better believer in the same way you can be a better chef. Yet you can. While you may think your beliefs are all set, the truth is that you might simply be more stubborn than a stereotypical in-law. The problem with that? A closed mind often doesn't allow you to see, understand, and experience other belief systems to give you a better picture of the entire world. These are five ways they can help you become more open and aware. Be curious, ask questions, and try to distinguish between facts and opinion. Know that beliefs are different from knowledge, which is often different from reality. You can't live your life totally blinded by a system of beliefs. You have to integrate them with the world around you. That is, belief is one part of life, but it's not the only thing. Learn from others and ask about their beliefs to open yourself up to new possibilities. Manage stress to avoid damage to the hippocampus, which helps regulate emotion, memory, and other systems needed for maintaining healthy beliefs. Say only positive thoughts out loud. Fill your glass up if it's half empty. Optimism, simply, is healthier than pessimism. In a study, nuns judged optimistic by their essay answers 40 years prior to death lived about 8 years longer. Longer and with less disability, by the way. Don't judge others too harshly. After all, as long as no one's being hurt, if they derive joy from their beliefs and you don't, who's better off? Don't always think so much. In general, emotions are hardwired, so they're very predictable despite their reputation as being irrational. Emotions have actions associated closely with them. In fact, they exist to cause action. But thinking is not about taking action unless it helps you override an emotional decision to act. Now, here's the catch. Wisdom must be transformed into insights that are fired up by our emotions for it to become subconscious and part of your innate behavior. Theoretical knowledge without practical application is not enough. In other words, your love and wisdom must be combined into an action, such as doing a good deed, for all your thinking to matter. Unless you get emotional about the task, it won't become part of your natural instinct. Stay simple. Happiness is really rooted in simplicity. Excessive thoughts and actions diminish it. Excesses cloud basic values. One reason is that motivation is about removing extraneous stimuli so you can focus emotionally on the important task at hand. In the end, happiness comes from filling one's heart with love while practicing charity and dispensing kindness. It's pretty simple, huh? It's all about you. We paraphrase one of our heroes, C.S. Lewis. You have a body, but you don't have a soul. You are a soul. No matter what anyone tells you that might upset you, your essence is beautiful and has been inside you the whole time. We're just trying to help you shine like the gemstone you really are. Live the ultimate beautiful day and improve your UQ. You've heard all kinds of tips and tricks that will help you become even more beautiful than you already are. But you may be thinking that following some kind of two-week ugly-to-knockout makeover would be like trying to put toothpaste back into a tube. The reality is that you can make small changes that will lead to big results in just 24 hours. That is, by slipping little behaviors into your regular routines. You'll re-engineer your life to become aware of the subtle places where you lose momentum in achieving your most beautiful and happiest life. Take the knowledge that we offer and apply news you can use so you can close the gap in the UQ. Go ahead and retake the test after doing our perfect day for 2 weeks and find the area you want to work on. Here, we'll outline the ultimate beautiful day, the perfect 24 hours. We've built this day around a typical weekday in most people's lives. We've left time for you to do your job, whether it's at an office or running a family. And we snuck in those tactics that you can seamlessly include while you're working your job or shuttling your kids. After all, improving yourself and your health shouldn't overwhelm your life. It should be integrated as a vital part of it. In this perfect day, we condense some of the best pieces of advice in this audio program to help guide you through a 24-hour period that will make you see yourself and the world around you in a way that you may never have before.
6 a.m. Wake up before your alarm clock after 7 to 8 hours of sleep. This is the amount of time your body needs to recharge. Plus, sleep is a major stimulant for your own growth hormone, which helps keep skin taut and vibrant. When you wake up, perform a few light stretches. Take just a few minutes to get your blood going, think about your breathing, and prepare you for your day. 6:20 a.m. Perform your morning beauty routine. These are some guidelines. In the shower, rinse your hair. You can shampoo whenever you want, but don't feel compelled to shampoo more than 3 times weekly. And wash your body. Blot your hair dry or use the cool setting on your hair dryer, but avoid the scorched earth approach. Heat can damage the delicate cuticles of your hair. Use a brush with smooth or rounded teeth or bristles, which will massage the hair and scalp without damaging them. Remember, hair is most fragile when wet. Wash your face and use a moisturizer that has vitamins B3, niacin, B5, pantothenic acid, vitamin E, and alpha hydroxy acids. You can also include various small molecule antioxidants like ubiquinone and ferulic acid. Remember to read labels on everything. Use a moisturizer that has UV protection. You want to protect your face during the day and feed it with nutrients at night. Use a deodorant, not antiperspirant. We believe you don't need to stop the natural bodily function of sweat. Simply use a deodorant to mask any unpleasant smells. 6:40 a.m. Brush your teeth for a full 2 minutes. Periodontal disease is one of the leading causes of heart problems. Use a soft brush and rub the bristles up toward the gums. We also like sonic brushes, because they spray into the crevices of teeth to have a cleaning effect beyond where the tips of bristles actually touch. Floss between all teeth so that the strand gently touches the gums. Brush your tongue or use a tongue scraper to help control bad breath. Use a neti pot to clean your sinuses, especially if you have chronic sinus problems. 7 a.m. Have a breakfast that may include 100% whole grains, healthy fat, fresh fruit, or a little healthy protein, such as egg whites. Some of our favorite options include steel-cut Irish oatmeal, total with 2% milk, yogurt without added sugar but with fresh berries, or 100% whole grain cereal with low fat or hemp milk. And don't even think about fast food at breakfast time, since we find that most breakfast fast food violates every good nutritional guideline.
7:10 a.m. Pop these pills. Your morning supplements should include half of a multivitamin with at least 500 international units of vitamin D, some calcium, magnesium, DHA, omega-3 fatty acids, and 162 milligrams of aspirin if you're over 40 years of age and have checked with your doc. Take the aspirin with a full glass of water. This will help you with your heart health, but keep this in mind as well. What's good for your heart and arteries is also good for your brain, sexual function, and skin because it prevents wrinkles. 7:15 a.m. Whether you're getting to work or getting your kids to school, we know you'll be spending a little travel time during the day, stuck in your car or in a bus, or if possible, on your two legs. Take the opportunity to practice some stealth Kegel exercises. That's squeezing the muscles that control your urine flow. You can identify these muscles by starting and stopping urination midstream. The more they are developed, the better your sex life. 8:30 a.m. Attack your day, be it at home or at work. One of the most important things you can do, create a clear game plan for what you want to realistically accomplish. Don't overwhelm yourself. Just systematically tackle what you can today and save what you can't for tomorrow. The ubiquitous to-do list works because it takes the pressure off you from forgetting the things you need to take care of, but that may slip through the cracks. And be where you need to be on time so you can control the agenda. Maintaining the locus of control helps us cope with and reduce stress. 9 a.m. Make a note to greet everyone you meet or talk to with a hearty smile, a genuine one. Upbeat people excel. Upbeat people have good relationships. Upbeat people feel good. 10 a.m. Take a quick audit of your environment, whether it's at home or work. A couple of things to note. The optimal work environment includes yellow light, lots of greenery, high air quality, and even a cube mate who's unafraid to crack a joke every now and then. Fiddle with the thermostat. Research shows that optimal productivity occurs when the environment you're working in is 72 degrees Fahrenheit. 10:45 a.m. Take a 5 to 7 minute walk and clear your head. Remember, the key to successfully managing stress and accomplishing tasks isn't about time management as much as energy management. It's about having the vitality to move fast, move efficiently, and move smartly. 10:50 a.m. Have a mid-morning snack of nuts or green tea. The polyphenols can help thicken the epidermis. Besides helping you stay satisfied, they contain biotin, which helps you metabolize fat and carbs. Add an apple or carrot, nature's teeth whiteners.
12:30 p.m. Lunch break. Two good choices? An oil and vinegar dressed salad topped with veggies and salmon, which contains carotenoids that improve skin elasticity so you don't wrinkle. Or have a soup, not cream-based, which can help slow the time it takes food to travel through your system, keeping you fuller longer and helping protect against waste and weight gain. Even if you're rushed, practice slow and deliberate eating. 1 p.m. For the other 30 minutes of your break, take a walk. Put UVA and UVB sunblock on your face and the backs of your hands before you go. A little sun on your arms and legs helps generate vitamin D. Or instead of walking, if time and the environment allow and your body needs it, take a power nap of no more than 30 minutes. It's the ultimate biologic battery recharger. 2 p.m. Whether you're at home or work, take a moment and notice the greenery around you. You do have some green plants around, don't you? The feeling of living things can be healing, comforting, and empowering, which is especially nice in times of stress. Plus, they add oxygen to the environment. 3:30 p.m. Have a mid-afternoon snack, such as a piece of fruit. Meanwhile, if someone tries to derail your beautiful day with a snarky comment or an unwarranted outburst, try to manage your anger by understanding why they're angry. It doesn't excuse them from lashing out, and it doesn't mean that you shouldn't stand up for yourself, but it helps you channel your anger so you can respond constructively or humorously. 6 p.m. Have one glass of alcohol with dinner. Our favorite is red wine. The alcohol has tremendous cardiovascular benefits, and the resveratrol from the grape skin that gives wine its color helps cells live longer. Lean towards a meal with healthy fat, protein, and fiber, and use small plates to help control portion size. Cover half of your plate with vegetables. Notice that you're eating early enough that the rich pharmacy of chemicals and calories in your food will be digested and won't interfere with your sleep or deposit themselves on your thighs. 6:25 p.m. Hug someone. Make it a good one.
6:30 p.m. Pop the other half of your daily supplements, including multivitamin, calcium, and magnesium. Then handle any household bills and chores you need to finish. If you're doing tasks, assign everyone in the family a job and work together. The teamwork builds not only a clean home, but a close family. For bills, tuck away 10% of your income into an emergency account, not retirement, but rather a true financial ER that can bail you out of an emergency to help relieve one of life's biggest stressors, cash, or rather, lack of it. 7 p.m. Call, email, or I am a friend, or your parents, or your grown children. You need to make efforts to connect socially with someone whom you care for and who understands your passions and can help you hit your goals and passions. That's one of the elements that will help you grow and develop a more spiritual side. Nobody home? Then write a note of thanks to someone who's influenced your life. 7:15 p.m. Do a yoga workout to strengthen and lengthen your muscles. The added flexibility, balance, and muscle tone will make you look and feel strong, energetic, and ready to take on and face the frenetic world around you. Add in 10 minutes of focused work on your core, mainly your abdominals and lower back, to develop your biological back brace. Not only will it help you develop a show-stopping belly, it will also protect you from injuries that will send you squealing for the ibuprofen. 8 p.m. You're just in time for your favorite shows or enjoying your hobby, but stay active. Put a stationary bike or elliptical cross trainer or rowing machine or treadmill in front of the tube so you can pedal or do other physical activity during your favorite shows. 9 p.m. Lock yourself in the bathroom, take a seat, and get into a meditative state. The bathroom, because it's less likely you'll be bothered there. Spend 5 minutes humming the word yum. That will help you clear your mind, de-stress, and start thinking of higher purposes and meanings of life beyond just getting the kids' lunches ready for the next day.
9:10 p.m. Now that your mind is clear of minutiae, take the opportunity to jot down a few ideas about how you want to live large and find a purpose bigger than you. Some ideas to get you going. Ask yourself the best way you can help others, be it with your time, talents, money, or emotions. Giving to others is also a heck of a high that you can give yourself. Plus, you'll live longer to keep doing good. Prove to yourself that you are something more than you thought you were. Assess your career situation and make sure that you're following a passion more than a paycheck, and that the company you work for has the same values that you do. Figure out some rituals that you can instill in your own family, be it a regular dinner or Saturday outing, or some other regular routine that keeps you close and connected. 9:20 p.m. Prepare tomorrow's batch of drinking water. Fill up your bottles and stick them in the fridge so that you have cold, filtered, not bottled, water to drink throughout the next day. Prepare yourself for bed with any cleanup duties. Brush your teeth, yes, 2 more minutes, please. Wash and exfoliate your face. Wash with fragrance and residue-free soap, and use a moisturizer with vitamins A and C. Remember, you're feeding your face at night when the sun cannot denature all the restoring antioxidant vitamins. Make sure the lights are dim and the room is cool so you can gently slip into restorative sleep. 9:30. Mutual massage with your partner. Start with the foot and stay there as long as you like. The benefits are more than just emotional bonding. A massage with oil, aromatherapy, has also been shown to have de-stressing health benefits. 9:40 p.m. Have sex. Feel beautiful. Tell your partner what you need and ask your partner the same. On alternate days, days not weeks, you can read a few pages of invigorating prose.
9:42 p.m. Just kidding, keep going. 10:10 p.m. Drift into sleep with a peaceful meditation, thanking your higher power of choice for the beauty of the day. Remember what made you most grateful today. Please note that you have nearly 8 hours before you have to awaken. Ah, it's the perfect day.
You Being Beautiful, the Owner's Manual to Inner and Outer Beauty, was written and read by Dr. Michael F. Roizen and Dr. Mehmet C. Oz. It was abridged for audio by Karen DiMattia. It was recorded by Bill Roth at Cleveland Clinic Media Production in Cleveland, Ohio, and by Mike DeCino at Simon & Schuster Audio in the city of New York. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The associate producer was Michael Noble. You Being Beautiful was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.